We were talking about the Lincoln experience, right? That, you know, I was in eighth grade, played in a band, did not play sports, and sports was a big thing at Lincoln, so you're almost second-class citizen if you didn't play on the football team, but not in a major way, but I think that was probably self-imposed, you know, but I realized that I was not a football player, I was not, you know, necessarily an athlete, so I kind of took up other interests. Had a relatively good experience. I guess one of the things I always appreciated about Lincoln, again, was just those activities that we had, you know, that everybody, the sense of getting excited about the football game or just traditions, you know, the May Day tradition. We had this great May Day festivities, you know, spring ball for the young kids, because the prom was such a big event at Lincoln. I mean, it was just like huge, bigger than life. And because the young kids couldn't participate in that, they had the spring dance, and it was kind of a great thing. You know, everybody came, everybody looked forward to it. And amidst your academic realities, you kind of had these other things that engaged you in the school. And I think that is one of the things that kids miss in contemporary times, is that they don't have all those other things that engage them, that hook them, in school. And we had that. We had the hooks, you know, so that even if you took a person who maybe is not inclined to do that well academically, you can get a hook on them because you got all the other things. And so they, I think people tended to stay in school for.
So the hooks were those things like the band.
The band, the football team, football. The other activities that you, there was so much a part of the community. Even when we got the school newspaper, I mean, my parents were as eager to read it as I was. I mean, it just kind of was something that you look forward to reading. And there was as much discussion about that as the kids had about it, you know, interesting things and things that interested the kids, whatever they were, however trivial they were. But, you know, and I think we lost all of that, and that was such a huge loss, you know, that sense of this is my life, this is my community, these are my people, these are, you know, it's just this community thing that we lost when we went out to the high school. You talk about repressing a memory. I think that experience probably was so overwhelming that the first year I repressed a lot of it. But I remember spending a lot of times with my peer group and not doing very much. I don't think there were a lot of opportunities to step outside of that, you know, to do interracial things. I mean, to participate with your white peer group. So most of my friends were still friends from, you know, the black community. And during my entire high school, I didn't have any sustaining, you know, white friends. I think that came for the generation after me. They began to develop friendships outside of their race. You know, while I was there were some guys that, you know, dated white girls, but they were pretty much, you know, guys who wanted to do that, maybe one, two, three guys who wanted to do that. But in the 11th grade, you know, we began to be much more verbal that this shit is not right. Something went down here that's not right. We don't like it. We're going to do something about it.
What were the things that you saw that were not right?
I tell you, I think they probably could have bought us out if they just hadn't gotten rid of our mascot. Now, as trivial as that sounds to you, coming from a football school like Lincoln and getting rid of the Tiger, I mean, that's pretty serious. It's like Michigan getting rid of the Wolverine. I mean, it just, I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But was just symbolic of a lot of other things, you know, that none of the traditions, I mean, the band, you know, the activities that we were accustomed to, none of them you carried over, you know, to Lincoln. It was all the Chapel Hill High School traditions. And we were kind of brought into their environment. And it baffles me that human beings, educators, would do that. I mean, it just baffles me. You know, what educator would not see the psychological significance of doing that? But anyway, that happened. When I was in the 12th grade, there was a tradition to have two marshals lead the senior class into graduation. Somehow, as a symbolic gesture, I guess we were leaving, and we said, this stuff is going to change before we leave. And that's why you'll see in the articles, this started happening around April or May of 69. We said, no, it absolutely has to be one black person. No room to negotiate that. They wouldn't give. We said, let's protest. We got together one Sunday afternoon. We said, let's protest. And we planned a protest. And our plan was to chain the doors and have a sit-in and not let anyone in out until they met our demands. Somehow, between Sunday afternoon and Monday morning, somebody found out that we were planning to chain the doors. And I remember his name was Minor, he was a policeman, it was somebody's father. He said, you know, this is a wrong thing to do. And I think somebody had alerted them that we were going to, you know, sit in. We sat in, and we had to sit in, and, you know, we just kind of sat in the middle of the hall and said, we're not going to move until you meet some of our demands. I don't remember what the list of demands were, but I remember that one thing was that we're going to be represented at graduation. You know, that is important to us. And there was a lot of discussions about our traditions and the importance of that and how you raped us of that. And I remember this day that, you know, once they found out that we were going to have to sit in, they wouldn't let people out of their classes. I mean, they kind of said, we're not going to change classes. You know, we don't want you to get in the middle of all this stuff that's going on outside. Now, Martin Luther King was killed in 68, right? See, I think that's the period of time that Rainey Newell is thinking of. That it was around the Martin Luther King disturbance.
That and he did bring that issue up, that was still on the minds of many of the students, along with all the uprisings that were occurring
around us. So we basically, that started a protest. And I think from that point to the end of the school year, there was never any peace. And there was question up until the end of whether we were going to participate in graduation. And that year they decided that there would be no marshals. Because it was also, they took, the tradition at Chapel Hill High was that you took the two highest performers, and that they were your, I guess, the highest male and the highest female, and that they were the marshals for the senior class.
The two head marshals.
The two head marshals. And I guess there were other marshals, and I'm not sure how they got chosen, you know, but our position was that we're going to be one of the head, you know, and they said, well, there won't be any marshals. We'll just lay the programs on a table, because that's what they did, gave out the world programs, and they let the class in. But the significance of that, I mean, it sounds pretty trivial when you're an adult and you look back on that, but the significance of that was that it was a child's world, and those kinds of things are important to young adults. But it was also symbolic of the fact that they had raped us of all our traditions, and that we wanted to rebel against that. It never resolved that year. But most of us, we did graduate, they did have a ceremony. Most of us did some kind of protest during the ceremony, you know, whether it was some kind of Black Power salute or whatever, we did some kind of protest. And we graduated, and most of us went on to our next life. But I think the generation that came after us took that to another level in terms of continuing to demand that. And it was during that period of time that they switched the mascot from the Wildcat to the Tiger.
And the colors,
and begin to, I guess, reevaluate the need to incorporate some of that reality into the traditions.
There were several, in the newspaper articles here, had several issues that the black students brought up. And if I might go over these, and if you can remember them and expand on them, I would appreciate it. These were that a committee be formed to select a new mascot, school colors, school song.
Yes.
You've already touched on the school mascot.
Yes.
And they did change that, and they changed the school colors. I don't know about the school song, what happened with that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember either, but as you're reading that, yes.
Then they say more blacks on the school newspaper staff. Now, you had mentioned to me, and it's interesting, your memory of the Echo being important to your parents.
Absolutely.
And to you.
Absolutely. And a very important document. You're living in a town that had a weekly newspaper, and you're living in a town where a lot of people are fairly isolated. I mean, at that time, rural Chapel Hill was rural Chapel Hill, and you had people in just living very isolated. I remember reading when I was in college, The Other American, where he talked about the poverty that nobody sees. And when we think of poverty, we always thought of Chicago and New York, but we never thought of the rural poverty. But my point here is that it was a form of communication to the community, that what's going on, and people depended on those communications. In today's world, it would be fairly insignificant. I doubt if anybody ever reads it, a high school newspaper. But then it was a significant piece of press. So people wanted, that was something that we lost. And to come to Chapel Hill, where they had their newspaper, which had a whole different editorial philosophy. Our philosophy on the Echo was to kind of talk about the things that kind of trivialize some of the things that go on at the high school or community. And the paper at Chapel Hill High was more trying to see how we can begin to teach students how to be journalists and to have our own little kind of New York Times piece of press here. So you would have articles that were flavored after good journalism versus kind of what the community was interested in. So it was very different, and so those of us who would have been active on the Echo would not have measured up to what they needed on the Proconium, because it was just a whole different flavor of news. And even if you took a newspaper that a Michigan or a Duke or a Carolina put out, and a newspaper that is Central or Shore or St. Augustine, there's a whole different flavor and what they're trying to do with those papers. They're not trying, or at least in that era, they're not trying to reproduce the New York Times on a kind of a micro level. They're trying to do something that's part of that community. And the way that it's done, or the style of the writing, was not as important as the fact that John Doe was in the paper, or
what's going on at the school.
What's going on at the school.
What's going on with sports, what's going on
right.
in the classroom kind of thing.
Right. And I can remember them belittling some of the, there used to be this little editorial piece in the Echo about, it was kind of the gossip of the school, and it would just kind of do it in scripted language or initial, did you know that SH was da-da-da-da. And you'd have to guess what gossip was about, but it was a big thing, And it never got too brutal, but interesting.
That was at the Echo.
That was at the Echo.
Uh-huh.
Well, that would have been trash. That was like trash journalism and not as far beneath the Proconium. So, just kind of you lost those pieces. Now, they both are, valid things, but I think there needed to be more thought into kind of consolidating that. And there, in retrospect, there would have been ways, I think, to do that and meet the interests of both groups.
At least some representation of what the African-American community had experienced.
Yeah. And interestingly, the person that was in charge of the paper, Linda Bernard, she retired, last year, year before, and she's probably one of the more decent people out there. Which, I don't know, I've always been amazed at in my life that decent people can kind of sit idly and see such atrocities and not act. And I use that standard for myself too, you know, as I've seen things in my life, and you know, kind of I use that to kind of drive myself to act. But she's a nice person, but I just think she didn't have the insight on the dynamics underneath all of that. So, but what were some of the other dimensions?
More black secretaries in the high school office. Remember that issue?
Yeah, I don't remember that issue.
Direct communication with the black students by the principal.
Yes.
What was the difference between the two principals?
Mae Marshbanks didn't know us, didn't have a sense of us, and didn't do anything to reach out to us. Mr. McDougall knew us. He knew our community. He probably knew how to deal with each of us individually. He knew what I needed. He knew what someone else needed. And had approaches for all of those things. And we probably had, in our own way, grown addicted to that. And once that was pulled away, she was a very different kind of person. Mae Marshbank was a principal. She was a very, very cold, detached person. And I think had absolutely zero insights into racial dynamics and no insights into black people. So I think it was just kind of a misfit.
I'd like to go back to that at some point, not specifically her, but in general, that idea of insight into black people. And I'd like to look at that both ways, insight into white people as well as insight into black people. That's a really...
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic, because I think that is the essence of what happened at that school, that was such a negative experience for so many black people. It is just a lack of insight, a lack of sensitivity. And I tell you, I can remember an incident when Dick Nixon won for president, and you know, most black people were just irate, and there were all kind of perceived repercussions from a Nixon presidency. And I just remember some of the discussions in class about that, and just a whole insensitivity to how a young black person might feel. And I can remember getting up and walking out of a class that was having a discussion. It was a math class, but the discussion just was kind of about the recent election. So there was just kind of no sensitivity to, or no discussion about, sensitive or otherwise, about why black people may not have wanted that decision. But just an example of, you know, just those things that were just insensitive, and I think the lack of insight, or even lack of caring. That year I ran for social chairman of one of those years. It wasn't that year, but one of those years I ran for social chairman. It was a position that you ran, like when you're running for vice president or president of the student body or something like that. And I can remember a teacher, I lost the election. You know, I think I got all the black votes and none of the white votes, but because it was a very desired position. But I remember a teacher telling me that if I wanted to work for my class, that I should start with something small. Well, yeah, I've done plenty of small things. It's just that she didn't know my reality, because I was coming from a different different setting, Lincoln. And that her assumption that because I wasn't known in the Chapel Hill High School, you know, student activities arena, that I hadn't done anything. And that was one of those moments in time that stuck out in my mind as like, that's an interesting perspective. And she kind of sought me out to tell me that. And I think she would have called herself reaching out for me, you know, to console me, you know, because I had lost the election. Because they came on the PA system in the afternoons, and, you know, John Doe, these are the winners, and then the candidates could go by the office and get the breakdown of the votes. And she stopped me in the hall when she saw me. So for her, that was kind of a reaching out thing. But for me, it was like, get a life.
Did she ask you, had you done little things
before? No, she said.
So the assumption is what offended you, that she assumed you hadn't done anything before.
Right.
That whatever you had done at Lincoln didn't count for anything.
And that I should start with little things. I mean, I think that's a very negative message to send. I mean, that was kind of a historical message that black people got from society. Yeah. Start with the little stuff. What else?
More black representatives on the student council and in clubs.
Absolutely. I would have forgotten that, but absolutely. Now, some of that, and they probably said, well, you can go to any of the clubs that you want to, but then it's that insensitivity to that whole process, that these are your clubs. Because I remember I was part of, I think I was Future Teachers of America or something was a club, and I was part of that club. But I was the only African-American that was being part of that club. And, you know, that's, I always feel, even today, that white folks don't have a great appreciation for what it feels like to be the only all the time. And I so often wish that that situation could be reversed so that people could just get an appreciation for it. I had to do a speech before the Board of Trustees at Duke, and I mean, I was a nervous wreck. I mean, I was totally nervous, and I was talking to, you know, my boss about it after the fact, and he was kind of giving me all this coaching. But I was just, you know, just acutely aware that he had missed a lot of what was driving that anxiety, that you still have this experience of having to get out there and having to represent yourself, represent your professional interest, but also you represent your race. You know, if you blow it, it might be a long time before another black comes through and gets this audience. If you do a bad job, you know, and that is just like so much pressure, so much pressure. And I think that dynamic existed back then. When you go into a situation and you're the only, you know, you just can't, you can't, it's hard to exceed. It's hard to exceed in those environments.
I'm reading the thesis of a white woman who looked at the black community in the black schools and was invited to Lincoln High's reunion. And she expressed the same fears that you expressed, the only white person in a black environment. And she was fearful of appearing in a bad light. And while she doesn't say she represented the white community, in essence she did, I guess. And I think, you know, you're expressing what anybody who's perceived as different must feel when they're alone.
Yeah. But you know what the most fascinating thing for me is that you have those demands listed in the paper, and probably very few people could look beyond the concrete demand and see some of the symbolism underneath that. In this great intellectual community that we have here, university, great psychology department, you know, renowned educational department, even in that time period, but that nobody could break that down. It baffles the mind that you couldn't separate. Who cares about the committee, about the, you know, clubs? That's symbolic of something beneath that, of people's need to be beneath that. And you're dealing not in an adult world, in a child world. So it baffles me. It baffles me. And even as I speak, I don't understand that reality.
It just seems to me there was such poor preparation that nobody knew. I mean, I've heard some people say this, that we just didn't know what to do. But I guess hindsight's 20/20. You can look back and say, well, we needed to look at each other's cultures. What were the similarities? What were the differences? And come together to some middle point. But I guess the whites must have looked at the school and said, this is our school. What are these dark-skinned people doing here? And the blacks looked at the school and said, well, we may be desegregated, but we sure are not integrated. And where's our tradition?
Right, and I know a big thing was there was as you know, Lincoln was a football school, great cheerleaders, and when they integrated, they took the most attractive, there was one, Gracie Durham. She's always been a gorgeous woman, she was gorgeous in high school. You know, long, pretty hair, and she was the head of the cheerleader squad at Lincoln. So they took the head and incorporated it into their cheerleaders. But that was it. No one else got that opportunity to try out or to... No, it was...
To even try out.
No, there was no tryout. She was selected kind of as the person. And I remember that that was an issue. I don't know if that was in the form of a demand, but that was a huge issue then, that we want black cheerleaders.
There are several more issues here. I don't want to belabor this, but I think they're so interesting, and they really speak to the fact that the Marshalls issue was really just a spark in dry wood that was ready to go up in flames.
Yes.
Psychology course to teach students to deal realistically with poverty, requests for apologies from the administration and school board for sorely degrading, in quotation marks, sorely degrading them. More respect for guests invited by the blacks. More respect for the three black cheerleaders at the high school. Can you speak to any of those issues?
I'm just fascinated that... pretty much, I mean, I look at that with a sense of pride that at that young age, we would have been able to break down the realities, I mean, particularly the psychological piece. You know, that's significant to me, that we raised that as an issue, that this is doing something to our sense of being and well-being. I'm amazed that we articulated that, and that's a good thing. But yeah, I think it was a very dehumanizing experience. It was then, and when I look back on it now, it was one of the most scarring things in my life. I left that school very, very bitter. And I think I, for many, many years, took that bitterness with me, that you know, you just can even in contemporary times do something like that and get away with it. And I guess for me it's like taxation without representation. You know, my parents paid taxes, they paid property taxes, they had a stake in the school. You know, they were stakeholders in this community. And as people, we should have been acknowledged differently. And I didn't then, and I don't now, have a lot of respect for people that let that happen. And maybe that had to be part of a long struggle. And in every struggle, I mean, some people's got to get, you know, you got to get, somebody's got to get the bad end of the stick. And we got the bad end of that. And so be it. But it was a difficult psychological reality.
Let me ask you some more specific questions. Did you feel prejudice from the white teachers?
Absolutely. Without a doubt in my mind. Yes. Significantly so.
And how was this manifest?
Didn't expect... White teachers and white students did not expect us to succeed. So when we, in fact, succeeded, they were more surprised than encouraged. I can remember a pop test in history, and again, my reading abilities, I can, you know, read and remember. And she was calling out the scores. And just kind of the look, I mean, she said, Sylvester Hackney, 96. And 96 was like maybe the second best score in the class. And it's just like people look at you, you know, give you that look and that feeling. I can remember getting in a fight with this kid, Harold Horn, one of the town bigots. He said something to me in a class Now, I'm the kind of guy that I take it on. I mean, you say something to some people, they look the other way, and that's a good way of being. But my personality at that time was, I'll take it on. So we had some words, and I said, okay, after class. So we met in the hallway, and you know, we went at each other. And I've never been a fair fighter. I'm a guy that, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to, you know, if I'm going to fight, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to hurt you, you know. And even now, I would walk away from a fight, you know, but if it came to the point where I had to fight, then that's what I would do. And I just really went at this guy. And he was pretty, I mean, he was, you know, messed up by the time they broke us apart and they took us to the office. And the principal...